You have to remember that we would very often drive away from a Grand Prix and there'd be a van and a caravan parked up where someone didn't make it. Sat on the grid on hundreds of occasions thinking, what the hell am I doing this for? It's pouring with rain, I've got plastic tyres on. Kenny Roberts would be at an international at Donington Park.
Yeah.
Always. He ran over my head on one occasion. So I was fed up with waking up with the smell of hospitals around me and not knowing who I was or where I was.
Hello and welcome back to Off Track. I'm your host, Dave Neal. Firstly, thank you so much for your fabulous feedback on our recent shows with Glenn Irwin, James Haydom and James Whittam. It's hugely appreciated. Not only is the show only as good as the guest, it's also only as good as the reception you give it. And week on week, that's becoming more and more. So thank you to you, wherever you're listening from, however you're listening to us. The show is becoming bigger and more popular because of you. As a regular listener, you know what we're about to do, so please bear with us. But if you're new, then you might be able to help us. If you enjoy today's show and you know a business that might want to work with us or advertise with us, then please get in touch through my email, offtrackhost@gmail.com. It's important we keep the show growing both with guests and production value, and we think our platform's a great way for companies to get their message across to our listeners and viewers. Thank you. Now let's get into it. In proud partnership with Express Coffee, the bean-to-cup coffee specialist, it's the arch-practical joker of the paddock. A man who saw success in Grand Prix motorcycle racing alongside his great friend Barry Sheen before turning his hand to truck racing with incredible success. Yes, it's Steve Parrish. So a huge thank you to Chris and his team down at Express Coffee in Milton Keynes. For all the exceptional machines and services Express Coffee provide, the link to their website is in the show description, along with links to our Patreon page, merchandise page, and our social media platform. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, it's Steve Parrish.
Ah, okay.
Right, start again.
Take two.
Stavros, welcome to Off Track. How are you? Lovely to see you.
I'm very well, thank you very much indeed. Yeah, extremely well. Having just got back from a great trip in South Africa, I'm ready to take on the next part of a sort of British winter, I guess you could say, but I'm trying to shorten it as much as possible.
You got a place out in Mallorca, so you can sort of plummet airways backwards and forwards?
Yeah, sometimes plummet, but sometimes EasyJet or Ryanair, because it's rather expensive putting the fuel in plummet to go out there when it's 50 quid on EasyJet or whatever. But yeah, we get out there as much as possible, look at the weather and see if it's nice out there than it is here, which is usually is, and head off out there. So that all works very, very nicely.
Wonderful. And you just come back from South Africa, having been down there with a host of names?
I have, yeah. It's a trip that I've been doing for about the last 5 years. Can't believe I get invited back, because normally I get the second time is to apologise. But I have been banned from using hire cars out there, in fairness. But other than that, it's gone very, very well. But it's something that's been going on for me for the last 5 or 6 years. And it's sort of all the South African riders, and they have a very buoyant classic series out there, and they love racing with the international. So we get an invite out there. This year, the star was Danny Webb, riding one of Steve Wheatman's GSXR 750s out there, the bike that Michael Dunlop rode last year and won the races out there, and also the bike he won the Classic TT on. So, cracking bike. Steve Wheatman's a great supporter of it. He's kindly sends an RG500 out there for me, which is lovely, with Paul Bolton, the mechanic that used to fix the bikes, and they look after it. Well, I've got three RGs in my garage out the back here, but I don't like using them because they break down and then I have to mend them. So, it's much easier to use Steve's. But a lot of good luck. James Hillier went out there. John McGuinness went out there, but unfortunately had a family health issue and had to fly back, so he didn't actually get to race out there. But he did come and do a trip around Kruger Park with us, and we saw lots of elephants and giraffes and everything, and then sadly he had to go home. But as I say, over the years a lot of Scottish lads go out there. Ian Simpson was out there this year riding, and it's just really good fun. I have to say, the South Africans, they do love a braai and they love a beer, so it's sort of a bit of racing intertwined with beer and braais, which for anyone that doesn't know is a barbecue over here.
Exactly that. I spent a lot of time with Jordan Weaving over the years.
So okay, right.
The South African, the braai side of things, I know how passionate they are about that.
Absolutely. And another lad that's really nice out there is coming to do the TT again this year is AJ Ventner.
Yes.
He'll be back over riding at the TT again, and I think at the Northwest 200. But they're so accommodating, so nice to all the guys that go out there. Whatever you need, they find it for. And if someone's engine blows up, and Howard Selby was out there, and the engine blew up, and someone just pretty much said, you can have mine, took it out and gave it to him. So it's a fabulous trip. trip, and I really, really enjoy going out there. And let's hope I keep getting invited.
That'd be wonderful. Mm. Yeah, long may that continue.
Yeah.
What else do you keep busy through the winter and then into the summer, business-wise and bike-wise?
In fact, I've got a Zoom call a bit later on today. I work as an expert accident witness for motor racing events, mainly for motorcycles, but do indoor karting events and things like that. It's generally when somebody has an accident and they want to blame someone, as goes on a great deal these days, and you see how they think the accident happens, and I have a look at it to see how it actually did happen, because I've got a lot of experience of accidents over my life in all sorts of different things. So it's something I really quite enjoy doing. I have to have a look at what happened, sometimes inspect the venue, write a report on it, and then sometimes it goes to court, so I have to go to court, deal with that. So that's one of the things I do. I rent out some properties around this area, which I have to keep on top of. I play a lot of golf and tennis whenever I possibly can. And events, quite a few theatre show events and things like that I do off season. Just about to start in April will be a 5-event with a tour in the theatres with Henry Cole.
Fabulous. Any more you can tell us on that, or is it still in the works?
No, not at all. It's actually out at the moment. Well, I think we start off in Hunstanton, then we go to Stafford, and then we go to Epsom. And there's 5 shows, theatre shows coming up. And I'm pleased to say it's been on the market for about a month, and most are nearly sold out. First two are completely sold out, 450 people.
Excellent.
So I'm looking forward to that. I get on very well with Henry. And in fact, I'll be working with him next week. Well, this is probably going out a different time, yes, but I'll be at the London XL MCN show working with Henry, where he's got a stage area for himself. Alan Milliard will be there, and they'll be restoring some bikes and bits and pieces and stuff like that. Sorry for a bit of noise out about. Someone's
okay.
Cleaning my kitchen. My wife's oven. I won't say my oven. My wife's oven, because I don't go near it, so there's a bit of noise going on with that. So that's another thing that's coming up. I've got a few talking events, after dinner events, to be doing through the winter months. And generally trying to keep out of a proper job, which I've done. I've done 48 years of it, so I'd like to think I'm too old to get a proper one now. So yeah, I've got a very nice life, I have to say. I'm very lucky that I can pick and choose some of the things that I do and not do. And I just love some of the events and mixing with people, and probably a bit of entertaining, I guess you'd say.
Are you doing your own shows as well?
Not this coming year. I've done 10 years of the Mad Tour, yeah, which has been hugely successful. I suspect there's got to be one more, because I've done 99 shows over the 10 years.
So there'll be a centenary.
There maybe needs to be one more to wrap it all up. But I've really enjoyed doing that. And a lot of people that haven't done theatre, they should probably try it, because it's all very well you do some TV stuff and you do this and do that, but a live audience is brilliant. I absolutely adore it, because you can get the reaction straight away from them. Generally, there's a few giggles and laughs, and people come up to you afterwards and say they really enjoyed it. And not just the what I call the hardcore bikers. I'd say if I have 250 people in a theatre, 50 will be ladies, and they've probably been dragged along by the husbands or the boyfriend and whatever, and they don't really want to be there. But at the end of the evening, there's a lot of ladies come up and say, really enjoyed that, thank you, and you know, they were pleased that they turned up. So we're a kind of a, it's not about gear ratios and jetting and races and finishing third and should have done this. It's more about the things that went on, probably getting to the races and getting back from them, and things that I probably shouldn't have done, as we used to do when you're allowed to do things that you're not supposed to do.
This is the beauty of what we do, of what we do with the show and the guests that we have on. Mm. Because I love the stories, and our viewers and our listeners just adore the stories. Mm. You can see your career resume on Wikipedia, they can read your book, it's all out there, isn't it? We don't need to go through that again, sort of year by year. We did that with James Hayden yesterday, because James doesn't appear too often. He doesn't have the book, he doesn't have that. And I think a lot of people forget what James did in his career.
Sure.
But with yourself, thank you for allowing us to come down to your
pleasure.
Fine place in Cambridgeshire. It's a beautiful part of the world.
Mm. Yeah, it is. It's lovely. I swear, I'm born and bred from this area.
In Hertfordshire now, sorry.
Well, we're right on the cusp of Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire, and they're all literally around this property where we are now. But going back to what James was saying, and I worked sort of with James a little bit, and actually used to do interviews with James when I was covering the British Superbikes for BBC. And James and people like James of his era often say to me, wish I'd born 10 or 15 years earlier. They probably wouldn't if they sat in my body now, because it's very old. But I think James probably missed out on some of the fun times a little bit. It got rather professional when James got into it, where there was some big commercial sponsors around and you had to be seen to be doing the right thing and everything else. But I managed to just about escape that, I guess you'd probably say. And you're right, it's I lived in a period of time when A, you could have fun. B, if you got into a bit of trouble, it was usually a slap around the ear hole or told not to do it. But the downside was that it was very, very dangerous as well. So it's all very well saying the good old days, and you hear it all the time, don't you? The halcyon days of the 70s and 80s and your Barry Sheens and Kenny Roberts and things. But you have to remember that we would very often drive away from a Grand Prix and there'd be a van and a caravan parked up where someone didn't make it. So it was great times if you made it, and it was obviously bad times for families if you didn't make it. So dangerous times, but lots and lots of fun.
But did that add to it, though? I often wonder if that, because of the downside of the sport was far more prevalent through the 60s, 70s, early 80s. Did that give you a bit more of that almost like a fighter pilot kind of mentality?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dave. I often sort of say to people, and I'm not qualified to say it, it was a bit of a war zone, and I'm, you know, pleased to have not been in a war, but I can imagine the kind of celebrations if you did make it when you'd had a big battle or whatever, and it was like that. And you get that a little bit with the TT, don't you?
Absolutely. Still now you do.
Yeah, of course you do, because I did the TT, and the jubilation and euphoria when you'd actually done it, whether you just won it, finished on the podium, or even finished it, you kind of want to celebrate that success, and it was a bit that way. It was a gung-ho situation. You went into battle with not with other riders so much, with racetracks that were lined with Armco barriers and trees and walls, and like the TT was. People sometimes say, why'd you do the TT? But Finland was a road circuit, Spa was a road circuit, Czech Republic. So the TT wasn't that different. It was longer, of course, but it was still just as dangerous. There were still lots of houses and trees and walls all around you. So, but yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It was a period of time when you went out there, you put your neck on the line, you raced your lovely old bikes, whatever they were. They didn't have very good brakes, tyres, or that much power, but we still raced very, very competitively and partied afterwards. Yeah, that's how it was. But as I say, I don't think you're allowed to do that anymore.
No, there's a marked difference between the modern riders that I speak to and the riders that I watched.
Yeah, sure. Part of the fun of my era, sorry, butting in, is that after a race, we might be in Italy, for instance, and then the next race might be in Belgium, and there might be a weekend gap. So you'd all, half the paddock would end up at Lake Como or something with their caravans and your barbecues and whatever, and you'd all travel around together. And it was known as the Continental Circus, and that was pretty much what it was. It was a circus of people going around, performing their things, spending time together, and then off we'd go. And if someone's diesel transit broke down, you'd all end up mending it, and you'd lend someone the caravan wheel that you might have spare. A lot of camaraderie around, an awful lot.
With the GP racing at the time, I had a question in my mind, it had gone, but it's come back now. Were you present enough at the time to enjoy it, or were you taken along with the thrill of what was going on to actually sit that time? Because I speak to a lot of riders, and one of the bigger things they would do if they could do it again would be actually to sit back and enjoy it more. Were you able to be present as much as you could be?
I understand what you're saying about did you enjoy it, or was it sort of having enjoyed it? And I think, what was I? I was a rider that sort of nearly enjoyed having done it as much. I used to get nervous.
Yeah.
And I've read lots of people talking about this. And I think it was young McKenzie, wasn't it, that retired.
Because Taylor, yeah.
Taylor retired because he couldn't stand the sickness feeling and everything else. I have to say, I used to get the same, but I'd push myself through it because I wanted to do it for a number of reasons, for myself, for my own self-satisfaction, probably for the team that I was riding for, or the sponsor I was riding for, and for the jubilation and greatness and picking up that trophy and whatever, all the success that came with it. But there is an element of being extremely nervous and thinking, why? I've sat on the grid on hundreds of occasions thinking, what the hell am I doing this for? It's pouring with rain. I've got plastic tyres on and my leathers that are thin as you can imagine and silly crash helmets that didn't work and gloves that were like golf gloves and thinking, what am I doing? But at the end of it, I went, that's why I did it, because that jubilation that you got of just having some success out there. And of course, not wanting to go back. John McGuinness often talks about it, not wanting to go back to being a bricklayer. Now, I was a tractor mechanic. I didn't really want to go laying under Nuffield tractors or things like that. So there was an element of being dragged along with it. You know, mixing with the greats of Kenny Roberts and Steve Bakers and Barry Sheens and all those guys that arguably were my heroes. I raced with them a lot, but most of the world champions were better than me because I didn't win a world championship. I finished fifth, was my best in 77. But I got on extremely well with all those guys and we were a community. But there was a period through, again, you have to remember, would have been late 70s when everyone got fed up with the dangers, the lack of money and everything else. And there was kind of a breakaway group that Kenny Roberts and Barry Sheen and I were all involved with. And a guy called Barry Coleman, who ended up marrying Andrea Herron, because Tom got killed in 79, unfortunately. Her husband, Tom Herron. But we'd had enough. And that was probably the start of the Erta situation. And we all know, tragically, we lost Mike Trimby recently. But that was when everyone had decided that we were having a lot of fun, but we weren't getting paid much money, not for doing Grand Prix. We were for internationals, and the circuits were really not capable of containing or having enough runoff areas for bikes that were getting faster and faster and tyres were getting better. So there was a bit of an upset going on around there. But yeah, I was trapped in that circus, absolutely adored it, and loved earning reasonably good money because we got paid start money back then. Unlike, I keep hearing about the British riders, but I had a contract with Chris Lowe, who was running what was then known as MCD, I think Motor Circuit Developments, which is Brands and Snetterton and places that Jonathan Palmer now owns, yes. And his MSV. But we would come back and, you know, get a couple of £1,000 in a brown envelope every time he turned up at those races. And that was quite a lot of money back in those days. So I won't take anything away from the fact that we did get paid reasonably well, but we didn't for Grand Prix. It was something like 200 Swiss francs to go to a Grand Prix, and it would cost you 500 to get there. But you had to do the Grand Prix to have the status to come back and do the big events like the AGV Nations Cup and the British Superbikes or whatever they were called then, Power Bikes and Transatlantics and things like that. So it was kind of a weird situation that you had to go off to do the Grand Prix to get that position that you could come back and demand X amount of start money. So it was a vastly different situation to we've got now.
It was a different world completely, wasn't it, in terms of racing and start money. I've spoken to Mick Grant recently, mm-hmm. and to Reg, mm-hmm. and Roger,
yep.
Burnett.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what you said. Mm. Reg made it the bulk of his money from start money at sort of the they do at Snetterton, Race of Aces.
Race of Aces, yeah,
and
absolutely.
King of Cadwell.
Race of Mallory Park event, whatever it was called. But
that's where the money was to be able to go GP racing.
Yeah, we generally would come from Italy back to England to get paid a load of money to go to Alton Park, to go back out to Belgium or whatever, and you'd come back as a full. So in those days, the Grand Prix stars and the big stars were, obviously Barry Sheen was probably the biggest in the UK, but Granty was up there. Would all come back and race in England, whereas you're never going to see, well, you didn't, did you? See Cal Crutchlow, Jake Dixon,
never.
People like that. Our British superstars that are out doing the internationals do not come back and do the power bike meeting at Brands Hatch or the Race of Aces at Snetterton or the 1,000 whatever it is at Mallory Park. So it was better probably for the fans because their heroes and superstars that were out racing for Great Britain would come back and race in the UK on numerous occasions. Yeah, I'd probably race, let's say back then there was 10 Grand Prix, I'd probably do 15 internationals back here in the UK. And Reg and Mick are exactly right. We would all have our little deals and we'd all queue up there, especially at Cadwell Park. What was his name?
Charlie
at Cadwell Park. And you'd be in a queue there, you know, for half an hour and he'd walk up there and he'd have his glasses on his nose and he'd look up. And I remember on one occasion, I think I won 3 races that day and I had a really good day and he'd look up and he'd go, so how did it go for you today? And you'd fall well out it went for you. And you'd have a deal where if you'd won a race, you'd get a bonus and this and that. And he'd count his money. Luckily, I'm beyond the tax man from that era now, so they can't come back to me.
There's no comeback on that.
No, I'm past that sort of period. But it was really quite funny, and you're trying to work out who got paid this and who got paid that. But anyway, that was all part of the fun, and then you get your little cash, and then you'd all stop off at the pub on the way home or something. You know, coming back from Snetterton, we'd all end up in a pub at Thetford or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, remember when you say about the riders that used to arrive in the international meetings. Mm. One of my first meetings that I can ever remember, and the listeners and the viewers know this story, was Cadwell Park in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And there was Barry was there, Granty was there, Reg was there, Will Hartog was
there.
And you're like, these guys are Grand Prix, they are the cream of the crop, mm-hmm. of world championship mm-hmm. racing.
Wow.
And they're blatting around Cadwell Park on the...
Even more ridiculous, Scarborough, Oliver's Mount, Jarno Saarinen would go and race around there, and Phil Reed would be there then, obviously Barry would be around there, and a lot of international riders would come over and do these events because they got paid reasonably good money to come and do it. And Steve Baker used to race over here a great deal. Kenny Roberts would be at an international at Donington Park.
Yes.
Always. He ran over my head on one occasion. I've got some pictures somewhere. I don't know where they are, but it was a Donington International or something, and Kenny was in it. Joey Dunlop was in it, and I was following Joey Dunlop the first lap out of the old hairpin, and he missed a gear. I ran in the back of him. Kenny ran over the top of my head. That's why I'm weird as I am now. And the tyre mark was, I haven't got the helmet because Kenny ended up buying it. There was a tyre mark right over the top of my helmet that came from his front wheel, and it went for auction, and Kenny still has the tyre mark over my helmet and sits and looks at it and realises that's why I'm so stupid. He caused it. But again, going back to it, there were so many big international stars that would come and race at our events because they got paid extremely well to do it, because there would be probably 40, 50,000 people at the event all paying good money to get there. So that was how it was, yeah. And they were probably good old times, but just sadly, we're never going to see it anymore now.
No. Well, that's the beauty of the podcast and being and the privilege of sitting here chatting with you and to bring those memories back for people and to tell the stories. So of those times, so certainly on the UK circuits, racing against those names and being a front runner in there, what are your best memories for that?
Transatlantic, probably. Yeah. They were a lot of fun. And you kind of just, you sometimes sat by your phone hoping you got the call, because I think there'd be 8 British riders, 8 American riders, and you had to have done pretty well to get in that team. And they were an awful lot of fun. Pretty hard work, because we'd race at Brands on Easter Friday. Mallory would be Saturday, I think, and then a day off, and then Monday was Alton Park. It was 3 days over 4. And the Americans were a wild bunch and everything else. And it was just a real good giggle and teamwork as well, because it's very unusual in road racing to have a team, isn't it? I mean, you might be with your teammate in a team, but you hated him because he was the first person you had to beat. But when it became the transatlantic, you all worked together and you'd help each other with the gearing and this, that, and the other, try and beat the Americans. One of my, my first year I ever did it was 1976. I was still a privateer, sponsored by Dave Moore on a TZ750. And I've got my bloody CF Bedford diesel in the caravan and I'm trudging around. I remember leaving Mallory Park to go to Alton Park. And we're driving up there and I've got my girlfriend sat on the engine in the middle, I guess, because you didn't have 3 seats in a CF Bedford, and my mechanic would be sat there and we'd be tearing up there. And this great big stretched limo came past. And as we kind of looked to see if it was the Queen or whatever in it, it was Dave Aldana and Kenny Roberts with their bare asses hanging out the window. They were mooning everyone as they went past. You know, little things like that. You just don't get it. And that would just be one of the stories. But yeah, some of it is probably not to be talked about, but we had a great deal of fun doing it. And I thoroughly enjoy that. Enjoyed winning my British Championships, of course. They're always very, very good. And there's a very famous story, and it's fact, and people say, is it really true, when I qualified for Barry Sheen at Mallory Park because his knee had collapsed? And a lot of people get that story wrong, because one of the reasons, I'm going to cut back here a little bit, one of the reasons I started doing the Mad Tour, which is my theatre show, talking about my life as a racer, which is what my book's called, was that it started off, James Whittam and Carl Fogarty started these chat shows going around. Yeah. I think it was called the Foggy and Whittam.
Yeah.
Anyway, Whit, who I used to see because I worked with him at the TT and things, would be chatting away. He goes, oh yeah, we were at Newcastle last night or the last week or whatever, and we ran out of stories half an hour ago. He said, so we told yours. Okay, sod off. You know, this can't be right. He said, oh yeah, we used up all your one about this and that and everything else. But he used to tell them wrong. So I would go to some of my shows and tell the story as it happened. And they go, no, you're not telling that right. James Whittam said this happened. Sod off. And James used to get it a bit wrong. And I think he was embellishing it a bit, that Barry got drunk the night before Mallory Park and couldn't ride. And I went out to qualify him. But it wasn't that. He got to the track and his knee collapsed where he'd had his Daytona accident and he had to go and see a chiropractor. So Rex White, the team manager, said, a bit of an awkward question, but would you mind putting Barry's helmet and leathers on and boots on and going on the number 7 bike and doing a couple of laps so he qualifies while he goes and gets his knee fixed up? And then at least he can get on the grid. And it was the Shell Sport 500 Championship, which we were battling out for. And that's exactly what happened. I said, yeah, absolutely. I always wanted to ride his bike because it was slightly better than mine. And I've always wanted to be Barry Sheen. So I put a dark visor on and off I went and did 3 laps, only to get to the hairpin each lap. And there's lots of girls waving underwear at me. Little did they know that behind that dark visor was a bloke with a big nose and big ears, and it's not Barry Sheen. Anyway, cutting the story short, I ended up doing the job, but unfortunately went faster on his bike than mine, so he was on the front row and I was on the second row. So I out-qualified myself. But just imagine Fabio Quartararo doing that for whoever, Morbidelli or something. No. So these are all the things that did go on. I guess if I'd have got caught, I'd have got a bollocking, but I wouldn't have got a suspension or anything like that. No. I'd have just said, oh, sorry, it's flipping dyslexia. I put the wrong leathers on. I got the wrong bike, sorry.
Dyslexic and colourblind.
Exactly, yeah, one of those. But, yeah, a lot of fun racing in the UK, met lots of lovely people and fortunately missed and lost a few. Yes. You know, that's the way it was. But still, luckily, Grant is around and Reg is around and a lot of the people that I competed with around that period of time. But sounds all rather morbid and sad. Unfortunately, they're picking from my pen these days. So sadly, a lot of people of my similar age are no longer with us. Still keep in touch very much with people like Charlie Williams, Stan Woods, and all those guys from my era. We usually now meet up at places like Goodwood or at the NEC show and places like that. So still keep in touch with the mates that are still around. And we all talk about the older we get, the faster we were.
Oh, 100%.
100%, no question.
There's no doubt about that. We had Charlie on the show beginning of January.
Did you? Lovely man, Charlie.
Incredible fella. What a story to
tell. I know he
well.
Is. He's a real raconteur, is Charlie. And he tells them with such gusto, doesn't he? He really does.
The listeners and the viewers, they maybe weren't as familiar with Charlie because his time was a little bit further back.
Yeah.
But I think we did 2.5 hours. I think I spoke for 15 minutes.
I can easily believe that. Did he ever tell you about the story when he stopped on the first lap at the TT with a TZ500?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember.
Well, I'm just going to quickly go through it.
Yeah.
The latter part of my career racing in the UK, I ended up with an X-Factory TZ500. It would have had an OW number. I don't know what it was.
Yes.
In it. But it came from Boot van Dolman. He rode it initially when it was new. It got passed over to Mitsui Yamaha that supported me and Charlie. Initially, it was sent over for Charlie to ride at the TT. And I'm going to hazard a guess. I think it was 82. And Charlie was going to use this bike because it was better than the standard for the TT. Anyway, quick story. He gets on it, starts off. Someone had lifted the fuel tank up. When they put it down, it kinked the fuel line. He got as far as Ginger Hall.
Yes.
And the reason I'm telling you this story is because I ended up with a bike, but he got to Ginger Hall and it cut out. It kept going, blah, blah, wouldn't go. Pulls up there. Someone was really disappointed for him. They gave him a pint of Ockels, the local beer, and he slugged it back down. Meanwhile, someone in there looked under the fuel tank and saw the fuel pipe kinked. They littered it up, unkinked it. By now, Charlie was half a lap behind. He was not a chance to finish. Jumps on it and it ran like a dream. He set the lap record that year on that bike with a pint of Ockels, finished up nowhere because he was so far back. But just goes to show that sometimes you can drink and drive, I guess you could say, but you shouldn't do it, I know. But Charlie Jeff definitely set the lap record after a pint of beer. But I ended up, after that TT, I ended up with a bike and it got nicknamed the Slug because it wasn't the fastest machine out there. But, well, it wasn't against the RG500s and things like that. But it was a bike that Charlie and I shared and that was it. But yeah, no, I get on very, very well with Charlie. We even go on holiday sometimes together and talk about stories and things and have a giggle.
Wonderful. What are your best memories of the TT? How did you approach it?
Very, very cautiously, because I was told by my mate Barry Sheen, you're an idiot, Stavros, don't go and do it, because he didn't like it at all. And I completely understand why he didn't. It wasn't through lack of balls, because he raced at places like Finland and Spa and road circuits and things like that. But he just felt it was wrong. And I completely agree with him on some counts. It should, my opinion, it was good to lose its world championship status because it was wrong to get Italians and Belgium and French and German people to come and try and learn 37¾ miles. And it was virtually impossible. And too many people were trying to get world championship points there when they didn't know the circuit. So to me, the Isle of Man has always been, and it was when I started, a race to do if you felt you wanted to do it rather than had to do it. So I took it very cautiously. I did the Manx first and on a little 250 Yamaha TD2B, which I've still got in my shed, crashed at the Gooseneck. But if you're going to crash, that's the best place to crash. But same deal, really, with the TT. I never won it. I've got to the podium in 85 and then got disqualified, which was rather annoying. I stood on the podium with Joey Dunlop and Tony Rutter, Michael's dad. And about an hour later, they said my fuel tank was oversized, which arguably it was, 200 cc's, but I'd got about 4 litres left in it and I stopped twice. But anyway, but it was that same old thing, that kind of such amazing achievement to do the TT. TT, and the satisfaction and the euphoria again once you came in there. And if you finished on the podium, it was wonderful. Even if you finished fifth or sixth or whatever, I've got 13 replicas, I think, to say that I finished a TT 13 times. And I admire the people that do it. I didn't ever take the TT really seriously. I didn't go ever to win it. I didn't probably learn it as well as I should, but I enjoyed doing it. And the kind of climbing Mount Everest, I guess you'd say, let's have a go at doing something that's the greatest achievement. And I guess in some ways it helped my career a bit. One is I ended up commentating on the TT. So my opinion, if you haven't raced the TT, you should never be talking about it because you don't understand it. And I think it helped probably with my start money as well. You got paid reasonably well to go there. So whilst racing motorbikes in my era, most of the time you self-funded it with your prize money and everything else like that. And that's what went on. But so pleased I did it. Have great admiration for people that are still doing it. And long may it continue.
When you did the commentary side of things, how was that to adapt to? Because seeing the difference, I mean, I've spoken about this before. Granty, I think it was Granty that said, if you had a chart that followed the bike standard and the kit and the rider from the early days of the TT through the 60s, through the 70s, and how things progressed, those guys at the beginning aren't trying any less harder than Michael and Hickey now. So as it moves through, then you see, 2014 was Michael's four in a week, and it was a busy time, and Gary Johnson did the double. How do you transfer that to what you did and being able to be in the moment for that?
To commentate on it, you mean?
Yeah.
I think I'm a pragmatic person, like you just said. The guys racing in the 50s, 60s on their Manx Nortons or whatever weren't poodling around. They were against the best in the world at that time. You cannot translate through eras. There's no way. You know, I'm often asked, which I'm sure you might be, who do you think's the best racer in the world at any period? Well, you can't say that because I think, you know, Jeff Duke probably was in the 50s, Mike Howard maybe in the 60s or Aggo or whatever you want to say, and then Kenny Roberts and then whatever. Right the way up to Bagnaia now or Marquez now. But what is incredible is how much faster everyone has gone.
Yes.
And that is, there's so many components that go into that. One is, of course, you have to remember that each year, generally, not every single year, generally, there's a new bit of surfacing at the Isle of Man, or they cut a corner a little bit, they might cut a tree back, or they might do this, might do that. But I suspect most of it is tyres and engines, yeah. You know, power of engines and tyres that can cope with them, and brakes that cope with all that. But there's no doubt that, you know, when I won on, finished third at the TT and the podium, Michael, Joey Dunlop won it. Yeah. Well, I'd like someone to say there was someone better than Joey Dunlop doing it. So he was the pinnacle. He was the outright guy at that time. It does look like that Michael might surpass his 26 wins as the TT comes up right now. I wouldn't bet against that. But no, there's no difference whatsoever. Everyone was trying very, very hard on what were, comparatively to now, shitty motorbikes. I was riding RG500s that had 120 horsepower. They had tyres about that wide that seemingly were made of plastic. The brakes, when I ride an RG500 now, I cannot believe how sort of bad they were. I mean, they were the ultimate.
Yeah.
And it was a rocket ship, but people were driving around in Ford Anglias and Ford Cortinas, you know. So that puts it into perspective. 100%. And they were flipping rocket ships at the time. They thought you'd pull their arms off and they'd be wheelie and here, they never. But 120 horsepower, where they're now riding 240 brake horsepower bikes around there. So, and the suspension works now and the brakes work now. Even riding an RG at a demo now, you're pulling the brake as hard as you can with all your fingers, whereas it's one finger on a modern bike. So very difficult, but I still believe that commentating on something, you get to know what that guy is thinking in his head and how far ahead he's planning. So I think when I did it, the fastest lap ever was someone, Joey, probably at 115 or something. I think maybe 118. I did 114 was my fastest. But actually, the corner speed's not drastically different. So the difference of a superbike now to the bikes I was riding is that they get from coming out of a corner at 30 to 150 about 4 seconds quicker than it takes an RG to get there. Yeah. So there's a lot of corners now that weren't around when I was around because you were still building up to it. But whatever, I don't care. Even if you went back to the 1907, I wouldn't want to be on the back of the bloke riding that Sunbeam around or whatever it might have been.
On the goat tracks.
Yeah, on the goat tracks that were around. So it's all comparable, but you can't translate eras,
no,
in my opinion.
No, I agree. And that's why I agree with Granty, and I'm glad you agree with that, because it's everything is of its time.
Sure.
And the effort was no less than what they're doing now.
No, not at all. And as Granty said, the equipment that you were wearing and the gloves and the boots and everything else were... and now, watching the modern-day Grand Prix, which I still watch and watch British Superbikes, it's incredible how people just slide down a road with their airbag going off and the boots that don't let their ankles do that. Our boots were like wearing Wellingtons and the gloves were like golf gloves and, you know, so on. I would reckon... If I look back, I guess I probably would have 5-6 crashes a year, and one of them would probably do a collarbone in, and one might do a scaphoid in or whatever. But now it's sort of 3 in a weekend sometimes, isn't it? And your airbag goes off and up you go. So it's maybe easier to push to the limits now than it possibly was when I was doing it, because the consequences were much bigger when I was doing it, because A, you might have hit a tree or a curb, and B, your gloves and boots and leathers and helmets weren't much cop at all. Mm.
What was your favourite section of the course when you raced it?
The finish line. I guess...
I'm retiring that question.
Yeah. I guess possibly to Ballacrain. And I don't know why. You've got to remember the other things that were tougher for us. And I'm now going back to say you can't translate. But I had to learn the TT in a Bedford van or a transit van. There was no onboards. There was no video games. There was no nothing. The only way you learnt the TT was either riding a motorbike round when the roads were open or driving a van around when the roads were open, trying to imagine what it's like to cut the corner here and there. And I guess the bit from the start through to Ballacrain, I found the easiest to learn. I don't really know why. Maybe because it was the first bit, and by the time I got to Ballacrain, my tiny brain had already filled up and I couldn't learn the rest of them. I disliked from Ballacrain through to Kurt Michael, because a lot of corners, particularly through Glen Helen, all looked the same, and I found it hard to learn them, and even tried kind of driving it and then shutting my eyes and got my mechanic driving back that way and driving it again and lap after lap. But it took much longer to learn then, because there was no references as far as watching onboards and things like that. And so the best thing I ever rode around the Isle of Man, and it was too late in my career to learn the circuit, was an FJ1100. Now, I don't know if you've seen one of them. It's about the size of my car out there. It weighs about the same. But Mitsui Yamaha decided the FJ1100 would be worth running around there. And this, I think, was 85 again. It was when the GPZ900 had come out.
Yep.
And the first four were GPZ900s. And I finished fifth on an FJ1100, which I thought was pretty remarkable. And I rode it really well. And the reason I rode it really well was because it never left the ground. It was so heavy. And I could actually see where I was going. TZ500s and RGs round the TT, it was like that. Yeah. And it's Charlie Williams that I think said it's like a rat in a dog's mouth. You were just being shaken around everywhere. Blurred vision, didn't quite know where you were going. And if you hit that bump there, you ended up there and so on and so on. And I think that arguably maybe scared me a bit at the TT, you know, because there was that bouncing around so much. I got on this FJ, rode around there. I had to cover the bloody speedo up because it frightened the life out of me going 130 through Bray Hill and things like that. But I actually got to learn the circuit better because it was easier to ride. Now, I suspect modern-day suspension is considerably better than what we had then. But I got a bollocking for that as well, because production racing back then was... bikes out the showroom, lights, indicators, everything. Didn't take anything off. Took number plates off, put a board on saying number 6 or whatever. And I got called into race direction for indicating and blowing my hooter too much. Just for a giggle. I was going through Ramsey, beep, 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 and things like that. But anyway, that was an experience as well. It was a big old wobbler, but there you go. Fun.
How did you pick the number 6, speaking of that? Because that's synonymous with you as your number.
No, it wasn't. Barry Sheen suggested it, really. Once I won the British Championship in 75... No, what am I talking about? 76, I won the British Championship. So I got the number 1 plate and had that in 77, and then knew I wasn't going to win it again because I wasn't competing in the British Championship in 77. And Barry just said, Stavish, you should pick a number. I've got 7. I said, oh, sorry, I'll have number 6. And that stuck with me, and I managed to keep that pretty much throughout my career, apart from if you hadn't finished... it was easy to keep 6 when I finished 5th in the World Championship in 77, because you kind of could choose from that. But
yes,
then when things dropped down, sometimes you got there and they gave you number 21 or whatever. But generally in the UK, I always ran number 6. And it's always been on my helmets, and the elephant's been on the back of my helmets as well, which is That one. That's only a little elephant there. But when I was a kid, I was a fat little bastard and I was nicknamed Jumbo. And so the elephant's on the back of my helmet because I think I was born with an overactive knife and fork or something and ended up as a fat little little kid. So I've always had an elephant on the back of my helmet and my helmet colours haven't changed throughout. And I wish other people would do that because as a commentator, certainly back in doing the Grand Prix now, flipping hell, everyone had a different coloured helmet every weekend. Whereas in my day, you always saw Barry Sheen, you saw Kenny Roberts, you saw me, you saw Granty. Helmets didn't change throughout. And it was so, so much easier from a commentary point of view to spot people out there. And it never ceases to amaze me. Now, most helmets to me look like someone just chucked a load of paint at it, or now it's all done with decals and things, but it's just a splodgy mess. Apart from maybe Rossi's got a theme there or, yes. Because of the colours and things like that.
So intricate now.
Absolutely.
When you go back, as you say, Reggie's helmet, black with the star at the front.
Absolutely.
Granty with the J and the L.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are synonymous, and you just wish that they would just keep that. And Kenny with the Eagles that John Kaczynski took on.
Yeah, it was so easy to spot people. Yeah, it really was. But I guess money counts now and commercialism does. And as soon as they bring out a whatever helmet, whether it be Rossi or Bagnaia or whatever, and it then sells again. And so from a marketing point of view, I see it does work. But it's a bit of a shame from that point of view because it was nice always to have whoever it was coming around Mallory Hairpin, didn't have to look at the number.
Your name has cropped up many times in conversations with the guys that we've spoken about already, with Granty and with Rog and with Charlie. Not usually in a positive light, Stavros, I have to say.
Yeah, on occasions I've probably... Trouble's followed me around, I think. I've been unlucky from that point of view. And probably a few practical jokes over the period of time and whatever. And maybe Granty. Granty's probably got a few... Yeah, I guess so. I can only apologise. I was a foolish child that should have grown up, but thankfully I haven't.
No, please never do.
No, I'll try not.
It's a trap. It's a complete trap. The story I want to know about first, if you would indulge me, is the Macau jumping jacks, because that story has come up numerous times where they were a little bit more powerful than maybe you expected.
Yeah.
But then you buggered off.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It was one of them things that just sort of like a snowball got bigger and bigger and worse because initially it was just a bit of a giggle. And it was after the Macau Grand Prix again. Bit like the Macau Grand Prix was just as exciting probably to finish than all the other races because it was the last race of the year. You have to remember it was like the final go November. That was it for the year. So as long as you were still walking and still all right at the end of that, then you had to party. And Macau was a great place to party with all the casinos and everything else. There was three, four people involved in it. It was my idea, I think, to set off a firework. And I thought a firework would be a jumping jack cracker thing in an establishment that had a red light over the top of the door. And there seemed to be lots of girls wearing very little with numbers on. I think they're called brothels, aren't they? I'm not too sure. And there was myself, Paul Butler, who at the time, Butler ended up being race director, of course, in MotoGP for a period. But at that time, he was the commercial agent for Kenny Roberts' team. And he was out there to meet people from Lucky Strike, I think, for future sponsorship and everything else out there. Howard Lees, sadly, Howard Lees was a great endurance racer, where he raced for Phase One, I think it was, along with Matt Oxley and people like that. He got killed in a plane crash in a pit special. It went wrong and he got killed. And there was an Irish fella who, to this day, I can't remember what his name was, but he wanted to be in our gang. And it was all decided, military operation at 8:30, I think it was, in the evening, that we would chuck this firework into this brothel. I went and got the firework, and it did shock me a little bit, because the firework I went to get, that cost £2.50, was about as round as a flipping 45-gallon drum, and about that deep, and I could hardly carry it. So it was slightly excessive, and I had no idea what it was going to do, but I thought we'd give it a go. Paul Butler used to smoke cigars, so he was a sort of like the touch paper person. And I think Howard Lee, or was it me or Howard Lee, was going to roll it in. My job actually was getaway driver. And we got a Mini Moke as our getaway vehicle because that's what you rented out there. Anyway, the electric doors opened up, blue touch paper that was much, much shorter than we expected literally, as it went through, and we were expecting to have enough time to run before it went off. It didn't. It just went off in the biggest sort of explosion you can imagine, with bits of red and blue paper going everywhere and smoke going everywhere. It was pandemonium. And these poor girls were shitting themselves and screaming and running out of there and everything else. And as the smoke cleared, and by this time, it was so much fun, I didn't even think about being a getaway driver. I wanted to watch what the pandemonium was. Out of all the smoke came these half-naked people that didn't know what had gone on. And what made it funny is I knew most of them that came out. And there was two of my mechanics that shouldn't... Well, two mechanics. One of them was mine that shouldn't have been in there. I must be paying too much. Boot Van Dolman and Jack Middleburg, dirty Dutch bastards. Anyway, so we didn't get away as quick as we should. And where it went horribly wrong... was sat at the bar watching everything that went on was the chief of police's driver that was waiting for the chief of police that was also around the back. Dirty bastard. I don't know what he was up to. Turned about getting a backhander. I think he was getting a fronthander. So that's where it all went crucially wrong. The guy watched everything that went on, and then they followed us back, and we got back to the hotel, and within 15 minutes, all the police in Macau had turned up there looking for us and found us.
Sorry to interrupt. We're doing our best to grow this show of ours, and you can really help with that. All we ask is that you like and follow on whichever platform you're listening on, and if you really enjoy what we do, then leave us a review. It's genuinely the most helpful thing you can do after listening to us. And also, while I'm here, a huge thank you to Chris at Riding Graphics for updating all of the Off-Track podcast graphics. There's a link to his social media feeds in the description, so please take a look at his work. And if you drop any work his way, please let him know that you came via the podcast. Thank you so much, and back to the show.
And took our passports off of us, all four of us. By now, everyone's laughing and giggling because we're about to be arrested. But they said, we're coming back for you tomorrow morning to sort this all out. And poor Mike Trimby, who was running the tour, had probably 200 people there, punters, riders, mechanics, was giving us a bollocking, and they took passports away. But I had two passports, luckily, one with my American visa on, so I gave them my shitty old passport. The others had given their proper passports. So then next morning, they came back thinking there was just some paperwork, and they've got handcuffs and everything else to take everyone away. So I, as soon as I could realise the situation, borrowed a hat, a cap off my mechanic, a pair of dark glasses, jumped in the lift, went to the first floor where I knew there was a ladder escaping, shot down there, jumped in a cab, went to the hydrofoil to get back to Hong Kong, which is the hydrofoil takes you back, and pretty much escaped. Got on it and got back to Hong Kong, sat there proud as punch that everything was going on and I'd got away with it. When I get a message from Mike Trimby, saying, you've got to come back. I'm going, piss off, I'm not coming back. He said, you are, because they've impounded all the Formula 3 cars, the touring cars that are out there, all the motorbikes, and they're going to impound them all unless you come back. So I had no choice. I had to get on the hydrofoil and go all the way back to Macau. And if only I'd had a camera with me, because now everyone's got cameras. But as I get off the hydrofoil, they've blown up the picture off my passport with a big wanted thing. As I get back to Macau, this got wanted. Steve Parrish. I wish I could have got a picture of that. It would have been amazing. Anyway, cutting the story, get back there, and yeah, we've sort of been in a police compound for 4 days until the British Embassy got involved and this, that, and the other, and we got away. I ended up, because it was probably my fault, the mini moat was hired and they kept it and for whatever, and the charges were going up. So I ended up buying a mini moke, so I still own a probably rusted away mini moke in Macau now. That was my penance and a fine and whatever. And I just got married. I had to phone my wife up and say I'm in prison for blowing up a brothel, which went down like a kidney stone. So yeah, one of these things that happened.
If I remember this correctly, and forgive me if I'm wrong, because a lot of the story we've done so many chats this side of Christmas, was the one point that they got their own back. There was some white powder.
Oh, yeah, there was. That was the following year. You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, that was Trimby's, I think, decided to do that. Or a bunch of, well, a consortium
some
of bastards.
Kind of retribution,
really.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, consortium
so
of bastards
from
got
your
together.
Side of study,
one
Russ?
Of the riders in Macau was a policeman, ex-copper, from Hong Kong, I think, or Macau, I can't remember where, but he got involved with it and everything else. So, well, yeah, exactly right. I'm in my room with my mechanic at the time, Dave Johnson, Big Dave. And there's a knock on the door, and there is three policemen. This policeman had obviously got together with some people, and they come in the room and said, we've got information that you're smuggling drugs and so on and so on. I want to go through your bags. And sure enough, I go through a bag and come out amazingly with this big white bag, a polythene bag full of powder. And I'm thinking, what? You know, I knew I hadn't been doing anything like that and kind of been set up and whatever. It's like one of these books that you read, isn't it, when you're set up? And they said, right, they took all this stuff and they locked the door, put me in handcuffs. That's it. They handcuffed me to the bloody bed. Dave wasn't in the room. That was it. They handcuffed me to the bed, but I was able to get on the phone. I dragged the bed across and got to the phone and rang reception. I think Dave was in the bar, got him to come up the room. And because I was a tight bastard, he had to carry his tools and luggage, so I didn't have to pay for them in the box. I got him up to the room and he got a hacksaw in his case with all his tools. So now I've got Dave up in the room, and the next thing, all the police come in and there's Dave going through their handcuffs. Anyway, it turned out it was a full setup and I'm panicking and whatever. I don't know what I was going to do when I got the handcuffs off. Run, I guess. And sure enough, about 20 people all came in the room laughing and pissing themselves because they got Parrish back. But I've been got back on a few occasions. Bloody Beatles about got me because it was a few people got together and phoned London Weekend Television. So we got this silly twat that lives in the village that keeps squirting our pub out with water from his fire engine and running around with an ambulance and so on and so on. And they set me up for that. So I've taken it reasonably well. I've never got mad, just even. Because if people get me back, then I've got to get them back again.
And so it continues.
It just carries on, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What's the most elaborate one that you pulled, the most elaborate stunt?
Oh, dear, there's been an awful lot of fairly big situations that have gone on. The one that's probably gone wrong the most was, and again, I got set up to start with by my mate that lives here on the farm. a stag got run over down the road there, which often happens, sadly. And I came back from the Italian Grand Prix with my wife, who is now my wife, now was my girlfriend at the time, Michelle. I was living in the Isle of Man at the time, and we had this place to fly back into, and went to go to bed late at night. Flight came in late, and in my bed, luckily with a dustbin bag around its neck, is the head of a stag sat in my bed with a cigarette and a pair of my Oakley sunglasses on, looking at me like that. They've chainsawed the head off of it because it was dead anyway, and put it in my bed. It was like something out of a movie, wasn't it? There it was. And I knew who'd done it, but I thought at the time it was a waste of a stag's head, just leaving it and chucking it wherever you would chuck it or burying it. So I decided, and again, this was midnight, we put it in my car, took it across to a friend of mine that was just restoring his house over near Biggleswade, and got some coat hangers and wired it onto his electric gates to the property, the big property he was restoring. He's in Mallorca. All this stuff came out afterwards. He gets a call from his builders the next morning saying it's a gypsy death threat. It's a stag's head on your gates, because he's had some problems with some gypsies on his land and everything else and got rid of them. And they said, we know this is a gypsy's death threat and they're coming to get you. He's flown back from York with his family to sort it all out. The police got involved. They decided that it wasn't safe for him to stay in the property where the building was going on because it's a gypsy death threat. Forensics got involved. Luckily, they hadn't got in my database, so they didn't get involved. He then moved his family into a hotel for a week, didn't dare go back to the property. And I didn't even know this was going on. And it was only about 3 months later, we had a dinner party or something, and it was spoken about, and he went, it was you. You bastard. And told us all the story about coming back from New York and staying in a hotel and everything else. He was not at all impressed. As you can imagine. So it all went horribly wrong. Cost him a lot of money. But then he gets me back. Very, very quickly, I went to his dinner party. Maybe a year later, he'd been thinking about it. He had six people there and strangely said, you'll sit here, Steve, Michelle will be here and you'll be there and this and that, which is unusual for like a relatively casual supper party in his kitchen. In the property that's been restored.
Yeah.
He spent all day screwing down the table to the floor, connecting a Goodridge bloody hose pointing at my bollocks to a fire extinguisher that had about 4 bar of pressure. Just as I'm about to drink my coffee, I shot across the flipping room. It was like something out of The Exorcist. It blew me clean off my chair across the room. And the bloke sat opposite me. I thought he was going to have a heart attack. He's just gone. He just saw me just disappearing across the room. So anyway, it could go on all day. These are the things that happen in my life.
It's worth having this kind of life, isn't it? I guess it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, I guess it does. But the trouble is now no one will let it go, you see. They go, oh, well, you're not having him round because we know what's going to happen. And he's not doing this because, you know, this he'll do this and he'll do that. But I think I've settled now a little bit because, again, get into loads of trouble now doing anything a bit weird. Imagine chucking a bomb in a brothel now or a firework into a brothel now. You know, just you can't do it. So... what is it they say? Once you shag one sheep and they think, no, you can't say that, can you?
But you can say what you like, Stan Ross, I don't mind.
My sort of past reputation does follow me around a little bit, but anyway, I don't care. The one good thing about getting old now is you can tell people to piss off, can't you? You know, I haven't really got a career in front of me. I've got a great life in front of me, but I'm not exactly chasing down careers of doing this and doing that. So you can actually say what you think a little bit more than... If you're a young lad nowadays, you've just got to be so careful. You can't afford to do anything that's a little bit wrong because they go, oh, we don't want him riding for us because of this and so on and so on.
So, but the majority of us still love it.
Majority of us do, and you're right, but we can't say it anymore, can we?
Silent majority.
Exactly. You have to be very, very careful what you do, what you say, even if it's your kids telling you off these days. You know, you can't say that, Dad. All right.
Okay. Watch me.
Yeah, exactly. Here we go.
I was looking at a couple of things last night, just before I came down, and one of the stories that I came across was one that I was completely unaware of. For some reason, was the condom mayonnaise with Rex White of Yamaha?
Yeah, well, Rex was with Suzuki's, but
was he Suzuki then? Sorry.
Yeah, there was a time when I was a bit bored, maybe winter, and I hadn't got a great deal on, and we'd be doing things like that. But my best one, I think, was condom chocolates. We used to get Frère Roche chocolates. Again, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? And put them in the fridge and then get the apple core bore out and bore the middle out. And the reason I used lots of condoms, I was kind of had a mate that was a marketing guy for Durex and then Mates and whatever. So he used to be sending me all the condoms that I put in people's pockets and things like that. And we'd just pop a condom in the middle and then heat the chocolate up and seal it all back up and wrap it all back up and then put it in a box and whatever, whatever. On one occasion at the NEC show, I'd left the chocolates out and people were just coming in and picking them up, but I knew there was 12 chocolates and only two had got condoms in. Yeah. And it was just like what is it when you pull we got one bullet nearly. It was Russian roulette it was who got them. And on one occasion, and I'm pretty sure it was Toby Moody that picked one up, and he's chatting to the James Wright has got a lady photographer he works with. I can't remember what her name is now. But anyway, Toby's chatting away to her, and James Whitten went, he's got it. He's got it. You can see him. Like, what have I got in my mouth? And clearly too embarrassed to pull it out, just boom, swallowed it. But it's not going to hurt you, is it? It'll come out eventually.
Sue's a photographer.
That's it, Sue, yeah. Anyway, they were some of the things that went on with, yeah, we did put a condom in with salad cream in it in one of Rex's chicken sandwiches and things like that. So, but then it was nearly laughed at. Imagine me now doing that to Paul Denning, you know, you get fired immediately, wouldn't you? Probably not with Paul.
Maybe not with Paul, but certainly with some
of the others you might well do. That was all the other thing. I got a number of people, Sheeny was one of them when he came to visit my house when I was living in Asheville, had a nice big Mercedes. And he came in for coffee or whatever, he was passing by, and I was just chatting away to him saying that we'd had problems with gypsies around breaking in and doing this and doing that. And while he was having his coffee and then he went to look at some of the bikes down the bottom, I got the keys to his car and wound his window down, and then I always carried and I've got some in the garage now, a lot of windscreen broken glass, and just lay it all on the seat and lay a brick on the top of it, and there's all this glass and a brick and the window's gone. And he came out, went to go, I said, I'm so sorry, it's the bloody gypsies again. This and the other. So I lent him the polythene and we taped it all up and everything else. And he was living at Gatwick, down near Gatwick. I think he went to Crawley Pippin Window Express anyway, he goes down there and once orders a window and takes the car and they took the door panel off, it's just wound down.
Wait, how much of an infant? I mean, we can't do a chat without talking about Barry, who was just the superstar.
Yeah.
Without a shadow of doubt. I mean, the influences on your career and you as a human, what are the best bits you took from it?
A lot. And I get a load of stick and I don't really give a shit. People go, oh, Harry's only famous for being Barry Sheen's mate. Well, I don't give a shit. And I've had a great life being
Barry. What an accolade, though.
I know I get that, but I don't care. It doesn't bother me. And yes, I probably have had arguably a better career because I was mates with Barry Sheen, but it was because he helped me.
Yeah.
We gelled immediately. We met. He lived in Wisbeach at the time and I was here, so we weren't far apart. We'd go motocrossing together and we'd just travel around. We had the same sort of sense of humour. He was a better motorbike rider than me by some amount that we know. Actually, interestingly, I was a better car driver than him. We used to race cars together and I'd beat him, but motorbikes, he was the man. But he influenced me a lot. I lost my father when I was 12 years old, so I didn't really have a dad. When I got to know Barry, he was so good at advising me. He was 3 years older than I was, started racing maybe 5 years before I did, and was a global superstar before I joined him at Suzuki's. And he was immensely good at advising me on what to do, how to do it, particularly with bikes and start monies and all the things that you needed to know, travelling. So he was a massive influence on me. And he was like a father, a brother and a best mate all wrapped up together, really. And I'll forever be grateful for what he did. And tragically, we did lose him when he was just 53 years old, 2003. And probably the biggest heartache to me ever, more than my father, because I was still young and didn't really understand all people disappearing back then. But yeah, we just gelled and enjoyed things. At times, I used to take the rap because he couldn't, because he was too famous. You know, when something happened, I'll stab and say it was you, say it was you. Because he'd be in the Sun newspaper and I'd only get an MCN, I guess. You know, that would be the difference. So I took the rap on a few occasions. It was one occasion when he took the rap for me. I remember a photograph on a plane that I took with a stewardess and she was really cross, thought it was him and slapped him around the face, which was quite funny. but yeah, a huge influence on me right the way through. We kept in touch, you know, a long time. Even when he got ill, it was just awful to see. I always thought that Barry Sheen was going to live forever, because you do, don't you? You know, you think nothing's going to stop this man. And I think he thought the same. Nothing, cancer's not going to stop me. And he tried all the holistic stuff and whatever, whatever, and it didn't work. But yeah, big, big shock to everyone. But, you know, the only thing I'm going to say, and I've said it to Stephanie and I still keep in touch with her, Barry would not like being an old man. I'm sure he wouldn't have chosen to die early, but he would have hated the fact that he couldn't pull any more crumpet and do all the things that he used to do. So he'd been a right grumpy old bastard, there's no question about it, even more than me, possibly.
Lovely to see the link.
Yeah, and that tragically is after, because they brought these out afterwards, but it's signed by Freddie and Stephanie, because they were around, obviously, after Barry passed away. But yeah. But I still think of the old boy a lot, and still a lot of things that I do be down to him. You know, things that were installed in my mind and brain would have been installed by the great man.
Yeah. Which I think that's why I think it's an accolade, because if we all had that kind of role model and friend, everybody's life would be a bit more enriched in that. So it doesn't matter if people are saying it in a negative sense, that's bullshit. You're your own man.
Yeah.
But to have that on a personal level, for me, I think it is, I think something we could all...
A lot of the stuff I do is to keep Barry Sheen's memory with people. Yeah. And a lot of things that crop up in my life that I did with him, I might put it out on social media, but it's more the fact that, you know, I want people to remember Barry Sheen. And it was lovely for me last year at Goodwood Revival. Barry, it was 20th anniversary since he passed away. I convinced Freddie Sheen, his son, to be my partner to ride at Goodwood for the revival. And it was just such a treat to have a Sheen on the bike out there sharing it with him. I clearly would have preferred it to be Barry, because he actually would have been faster than Freddie. But nevertheless, it was still nice to keep that connection going. Yeah, and I'll always enjoy, and I'll always be happy to get on a number 7 bike or whatever. And if I want to have to dress up as Barry Sheen again, I'll happily do it. But I will keep that name going. There's been, for maybe now 7 years in the pipeline, even 8 years, a possibility of a movie, and tragically it hasn't happened yet. I wonder if it ever will. It's been a long time coming. I'm told by the producer that wants to do it, that lives in Australia, they're struggling to find a lead actor of some note to get it all rolling. But it will be a great sort of, whether you want to call it a biopic or a biopic, there's lots of people call it differently. It would be on the lines of Rush, the Niki Lauda, James Hunt thing. But I think it'd be better because I think Barry actually has a better story, or the Sheen life does. You couldn't even script it like it was it? You know, young kid, Cockney kid, makes it good, rides motorbikes, wins world championships, marries supermodel, crashes his brains out at Daytona, nearly dies, then does it again at Silverstone, two world championships, retires, becomes very famous in Australia as a commentator and a famous person doing adverts, gets cancer tragically and dies. You know, it's got all the script is in there, and you couldn't hardly think of a script like that. And it would be a wonderful movie, and it would be a great accolade for the Sheen family if it does happen. I hope it does, but it's all about finding lead actors, I guess, financing it and see if it comes together. And if they don't soon do it, I won't be here to flipping see it.
The movie poster keeps floating around every now and again, doesn't it?
It does, and there is, I'm told, the funding for it, and I've never tried to make a movie, but I am told unless you get a big name up front to wrap everyone else around it, it's very difficult to start anything off of any note. So we'll have to wait and see, but I still keep in touch. Guy's called Rod Morris that is putting it all together, and fingers crossed it might happen. People often say, who's going to play me? And I did say Ken Dodd, but he's gone and passed away now. I don't know. We'll see. But I honestly think it would be well watched and well revered.
Something that you segue nicely into there is Goodwood and the revival, and how much of a massive supporter you are of that event. Mm. For people who haven't, I haven't been this year. I'm making the effort to go down. So. Yeah. If you get a couple of spares.
They are like rocket or shit. There's no doubt about it. And I don't know if I'll be riding. I've retired the last 2 years. And I sort of retired and I was racing. My partner was Richard Cooper, who was so fast because he only weighs about 6 stone, doesn't he? And he was faster than I was by some margin. And when we ended up finishing on the podium, we got third there. And then he couldn't do the following year because of he was having a baby, yes, or his wife was having a baby. So I retired at the end of that. And then Freddie said he would do it, so I came back. And I've said I've retired now, but who knows? I don't know. I'd like to be there because I thoroughly enjoy it. I might be team manager or something. We'll wait and see. But it is a great event. And it's a bit like going back even older than I am. I'm riding bikes that are older than I am. I'm seeing people dressed up older than even I did. But I just love that going back into time before my time when it was just good, looked good. People wore ties and shirts and jackets and
every day just to go to the shops.
Absolutely. You even see pictures racing motorbikes wearing ties, don't they? Back in the day. So yeah, make the effort and go along because I know you'll enjoy it.
It's something that we definitely want to do. Just to touch on there, we're sort of hopping backwards and forwards because I like this. It's just a general chat rather than something chronological. That sort of reminds me of your time at Loctite Yamaha. You say maybe be a team manager.
I was actually late
80s, early 90s.
It was from 87 onwards through to 91. And actually, I wasn't just a team manager, I owned the team. I was very fortunate when I retired in 86. I was player manager in some ways because I was riding and had Kenny Irons riding with me for the Loctite Yamaha team.
Bless him, yeah.
Had a great association with Loctite that were based in Welwyn Garden City, just up the road here. And I had a good association with Yamaha. And I sort of felt I should retire. I wasn't getting any faster. I was fed up with waking up with the smell of hospitals around me and not knowing who I was or where I was. And I was only 32, which is quite young by comparison nowadays. But I felt that it was a good time to do it. I just got married, got a daughter, was on the way. And so it seemed like a good idea. So Yamaha wanted me to continue being involved and Loctite wanted me to be involved. So I had my own workshops 5 miles from here. I put it all together with my first two riders were Keith Hewin and Trevor Nation. I wanted Kenny Irons, but Suzuki's paid more than I could afford to with the budget that I had. But he went off, and so I had those two. Keith Hewin won the Superstock Championship for me that first year. Following year, I had Mark Phillips and Keith Hewin. Then Keith retired. I had Terry Reimer got involved with Mark Phillips, and then Rob McElney got involved. And it evolved into a very, very professional team, arguably the biggest and probably most successful team in the UK from that period of time. We won three British championships through that period of 5 years. Finished won races in World Superbikes with Terry Reimer and podiums with Rob McElney. And it was good. But that had to come to an end. Talk about jumping from one thing to another because I'd started racing trucks. Yeah. And I'd also started doing a bit of commentary. So I'm now juggling about four jobs, and it just wasn't going to work. And I understood it. Yamaha understood it. I was actually, by the end of my team management thing, I was commentating racing trucks, running the team, even commentating on Red Bull Air races because I got involved with aviation as well. So I had to decide. And I decided in end of 91 that I could run a team at any age, but I couldn't go racing at any age. And the truck racing was getting bigger and bigger. Mercedes-Benz had signed me up to be their one of their drivers with a pretty substantial fee, I have to tell you. I felt that I wasn't going to, not so likely to die in a truck as I was on a motorbike or get hurt. And it was a factory job. I used to just fly into the races, race the truck, and I guess you'd have to say successfully. I won five world championships for Mercedes. I got paid a load of money to do it. They used to give me free cars and free fuel because I was sponsored by BP. I was living the dream. But also doing the commentary. In between, I'd work on World Superbikes and MotoGP, juggling things around a little bit. In fact, Roger Burnett, who you work, who you did an interview with, used to do the weekends I couldn't do. So we dovetailed all that around. And I was told, again, it was Barry Sheen. I know it's an old saying, when one door shuts, another one opens. But the key fact is you've got to keep the corridor short. And boy, did I keep the corridor short. For I went from racing to team management to commentary to truck racing. And it just sort of actually all flowed in together. But the Loctite Yamaha team was very, very successful. And I did enjoy doing it. Not as much as racing, don't get me wrong. Because when you win, it's the guy on the bike going around waving to the crowd. And when it goes wrong, it's that twat of a team manager. So there is sort of downsides to it. But it worked extremely well. And then it worked very well at the end of it because Rob McElhinney was about to retire. He did one more year and he was keen on running a team. So I literally took the team and handed it over to him, including the truck and the bikes and everything that went with it. But again, good times. And then, as I say, truck racing turned up and Bob's your uncle, went well.
I remember going to one of the truck meets actually at Donington Park. But there was yourself and Barry was racing as well.
That's right.
In the Klaus Taylor's?
Klaus Taylor's, yeah, that was the alcohol-free beer.
Isn't it amazing what you remember?
In a DAF.
That's
yeah,
not
well
even
done.
Looking that
it
old.
Was
that's
Sherwood DAF, Klaus Taylor, one of the early alcohol-free beers, yeah. I think it was. And he didn't have a lot of success in trucks, actually. But prior to that, he'd raced for Toyotas in touring cars and done some bits and pieces and so on and things like that. And Barry didn't really like car racing that much. He did it because he got paid to do it. And it was another way of being competitive, doing something. But he just didn't gel as much, probably, as I did. And a number of people have told me that they reckon I'd have been a better car racer than a bike racer. But it just happens that way that maybe because I wasn't as brave as I should have been on a bike, and you can be braver in a car, I don't really know. But I had a fair bit of success racing Caterhams in between the trucks. BP, my sponsors from the UK, decided it'd be better if I did a few more UK races. Yeah. So rather than doing the trucks, I did some sports car racing and enjoyed that. But yeah, Barry did have a go. And that's why same old deal, Barry Sheen got me into truck racing. Not physically, but he rang me up and said, oh, I'm doing this truck race at Donington Park. And it was the multi-part truck Grand Prix. And I think it was 84. I was still racing bikes. He'd retired. And 85. And I said, oh, I'm bloody jealous about that because I'd love to do that because I knew when he did something, I was as good as him, if not better. So I went to Mercedes-Benz in Milton Keynes, said, Steve Parrish, Barry Sheen, my teammate or my mate, is racing a DAF truck. Have you got a Mercedes? And they said, well, we haven't actually got one here, but we've got a dealer that's interested in doing it. It was a company in Ipswich called Mitchell Cotts. They delivered a truck, and they were road-going trucks back then. And they said, you do have an HGV, don't you? I said, oh, yeah, of course I do. I'd driven a Transit before. So first time in it, I drove it up the road, and I didn't get the gears right, and I was saying, oh, I'm more used to an ERF or something. Bullshit, as usual. Anyway, that race took place, and it was the biggest crowd Donington Park has ever, ever had. They shut the M1, and there was over 100,000 people turned up. And it was all promoted by a guy called Mike Smith, who was the DJ or the Radio 1 DJ yeah. at the time, and he raced cars as well. And it was huge. And I think I ended up second, did pretty good in it. And it just snowballed from them. This company from Ipswich wanted to do more, and they signed up another driver, a teammate called Barry Lee, who was a stock car racer. And it went on. And so much so, Mercedes UK then got involved, built a truck up north, wherever their base was, a specific truck for me to race. And I went on to win lots of national races and some international races with it. And then got a call from Mercedes-Benz Germany would you come over and test one of our trucks? And I went to Nürburgring, the short track at Nürburgring, and went about a second and a half faster than their factory drivers and signed contract. And that was it for 10 years doing truck racing.
An incredible career in the big rigs.
I know. Yeah, absolutely. And I did have a lot of success, had a few crashes and damaged a few things, but again, thoroughly enjoyed it. Nowhere near as much as motorbikes. I enjoyed it, and it was better than doing something normal, and it was actually more fun than running a team. But it doesn't give you the same satisfaction and exhilaration as motorcycle racing. And you can tell motorcycle racing is the pinnacle. You can tell that because all the Formula One guys watch it and they follow it and they love it because they know how tough it is. You know, it's all very well going around turn three at Silverstone and spinning and flat spotting your tyres, but on a motorbike, you're sliding down the road at 120 miles an hour. So that's where you get the greatest satisfaction from. And I don't know of anything, and I've tried lots of weird, wonderful, dangerous things, but riding a bike around somewhere like the TT is the ultimate.
Or Scarborough.
Well, I will be back this coming year.
That's somewhere you've got a big affinity to. Winning the Gold Cup in 81.
Yep.
Barry was very successful there. You were successful there.
Yep.
What is it about Oliver's Mount?
I don't know. I guess it's the mini TT factor. It's the fact that the crowd is so close to you, they can see. Great place to spectate. If you've never gone and watched motorbike racing at Oliver's Mount, get yourself there because you're stood on the bank watching people come over the jumps, coming down there. Andy Hayes has done a really good job there, bringing it all back from death, really, because it had pretty much disappeared. Pete Hillaby sadly got ill and it fell apart. Then Granty and Eddie Roberts got involved and they knew that they'd got a period of time they wanted to get rid of it. Andy Hayes got it, and I think COVID came along, and then the council came along, and so many things went wrong for him. But he's gradually chipped away and he's got it back on its feet, and I'm hoping to be there and make it a massive Barry Sheen festival this coming summer, where we can see lots of bikes turn up all in the Sheen Texco Heron colours or whatever Barry Sheen raced in, whether it be the blue and white stuff in his early days or the Texco Heron or the DAF Yamahas or whatever, Akai, don't care, just come along.
The Akai one's still my favourite.
Yeah, it looks
with
good.
With the speed blocks.
It's really good. So hopefully Grant will be along as well and we can tell a few stories and I'll try not to upset him. Did he ever tell you about... he'd done something to me, and I can't remember what it was. And again, it's connected to Scarborough because Pete Hillaby used to run a motorcycle show at York Raceway.
Yeah.
The club, whatever the club was. And they'd have a dinner there, presentations, and Granty and I would be there to perhaps give out the trophies. Or
Elvington.
Yeah. Anyway, Granty was sat on my table. I think Roger Marshall might have been there, and we've got a sort of table with us old racers on it or whatever. And I was up at the show because I used to have a joke shop at the shows. Instead of selling spanners and tyres or wheels or whatever, I'd sell flipping, I don't know, stink bombs and
shattering
stuff
teeth.
Yeah, whatever. Stupid, childish stuff. But I used to make a fortune because I'd sell that silly string stuff and all that used to get sprayed and stink bombs and false dog turds and all the standholders would come and buy things from me. That night, can't remember what Grant had done, but he'd done something. So after dinner, laid out dinner, coffee was coming around. I went around the back and gave the waitress a fiver to bring a tray of sweets out and put on the table. But I'd actually rescued them. They were orangey-coloured things. They're out the toilet. Then blocks you put in the toilet. Disinfectant things. And got them all laid out so they look like sweets. And Granny puts one in his mouth. And he was not at all impressed, as you can imagine. But they laid out so nicely. They did look like sweets. And he's popped one in his mouth. I wish I got a picture of his face that day.
I love Granty. Because he was always a straight man, wasn't he? He was compared with Rog. With Reg, that was sort of the playboy. He was liked to be. But Mick was the proper
Gritty Yorkshire miner's son.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
And we saw him at a fundraiser just after Christmas. It was just after New Year, actually.
Mm.
And we did, these are the situations sometimes, like in a lot lesser level with you, with Barry. But doing this, I was invited over to do a fundraiser for a young fella, Teddy, that has kidney issues.
Okay, right.
So I did the chat show there. Stewie Smith organised it.
Yeah.
And there's Reg at that side, there's Granty, there's me, there's Roger Burnett, and there's Gaz Johnson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm sat there like, fuck, why am I sat here doing this? This is ridiculous.
Yeah,
the stories that they tell, again, you crop up so often.
Yeah.
One thing, I know we're running on time at the moment. One of my favourite questions I always ask a guest especially your first time. I know we did one for Motopod many years ago over Skype, but this is the first time we've had a chance to do one in person. My final question to every guest is, what's your best hire car story? And who pops up the most?
Weird, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I've often had these issues where throttles have stuck and whatever.
Like at Daytona and places
like
that.
Yeah, Daytona was one of them. I think one of the funniest ones, there's been lots. I could name lots and lots, but one of the ones that always makes me giggle, and it was Charlie Cox, who some people loved him, some didn't. He was my co-commentator for probably seven or eight years. A lot of years after Lee Diffie, Charlie joined the team, and Charlie was a bit of a straight man, but he did love a hire car chase or whatever we would be up to. He never really drove much. He liked being my co-driver, I guess you'd say, you know, over crest 30 left and that sort of thing. But we always had a bit of fun, and we were at Germany, Lausitzring it was, which is now longer Lausitzring, where they had World Superbikes. And we found a way back to our hotel. When I was working for BBC, they'd book hotels around. It was about 6-7 miles. But we found a bit of a shortcut, which took you on this dirt road. And so each night we'd be going back on this dirt road, and we'd literally be going, right, let's see if we can do it a minute quicker today. And it was like water puddles, and it was like, just like a rally track. You'd think it was a RAC rally. And we had a Renault Turd or whatever it was. I don't know, Spass or something. I can't remember whatever it was. But Renault did do rallying because I used to watch them. So they shouldn't build cars that don't go rallying, should they? But this particular weekend, Colin Edwards had got his motorhome parked with his wife at the Lausitzring, and he wanted to get back somewhere, and he was going to leave his motorhome there and go back to Frankfurt. I can't remember the airport. I think it was probably Frankfurt. And asked us if we'd give him a lift back, Charlie and I. I said, yeah, no problem whatsoever. And so on the Sunday night, we went back to the hotel. We got the lap time down, get back to the hotel fairly well. And we were due to pick Colin up 9 o'clock on Monday morning, him and his wife, to go off to Frankfurt, all sorted. Well, on the way back to the circuit in the morning, we used the rally track for the last time, and we were determined to get under 3 minutes or whatever it was. Anyway, I hit a bump so hard on this thing. We were up in the air in this Renault, whatever it was, and when it landed, it died nearly. Unfortunately, all the lights came on and everything else because we took the sump off. And we're only about a mile from Colin's motorhome by now. So I managed to nurse it back. I said to Charlie, I think I've caught it, like you say on a two-stroke. I think I've caught it. And all the lights are flashing. As we came into Lausitzring, this thing is starting to rattle because it's got no oil in it, and all the lights are flashing and everything else. And it's punched the suspension things through the wing. So the whole suspension trucks are bulging through the wings and everything because it landed real heavy. And we pulled up at Colin. And by now, we're a few minutes late, and Colin and his missus have got their bags out, and they're literally ready to put them in the car. And he's going, lift the boot. And I'm going, Colin, no, we're not going anywhere, because this thing is now smoking and rattling like you can't believe. We're not going. And he's going, ah, no. You know, Colin, he's chewing his tobacco or whatever. And I said, no, we're going to have to get a replacement. This one's died. So I phoned up our producer at the time, can't remember which one it was, and said, have you left? No. Can you come round and come to the track? Promised to give Colin a lift in this, and they'd got people in the car already. So I had to sit in the back of this car in the boot. I'd sit in the boot because I was the one that caused the damage, and they're all sat on each other's lap. We get back to Frankfurt Airport, and it was Hertz. I went there with the paperwork and this, that, and the key. I said, brought these paper. I've actually left the car at the circuit because a red light came on and I didn't want to destroy the car. And this guy said, oh, sorry, he said in his German, I can't speak German at all, but Achtung Fahrenlager or something. That's so kind of you, he said, because so many people just drive our cars when the lights come on and they ruin these cars. And it's really kind of you, and this and the other. And I'm going to give you a 5-star rating and like that. And you maybe get some discount on the next one. Well, about 2 days later, Belinda Rogerson was the main producer for the series. She gets a bill from Hertz for €14,000 or something like that. It was astronomical. Anyway, it took a bit of sorting out and odds and ends and whatever. And I can't remember how I got out of it, but I did. I denied this and everything else. But this poor car was absolute scrap. The suspension had gone through the wings. The engine was broken and whatever. But we got Colin to the airport, and apologies to Hertz, that's all I can say. Yeah, it was one of them situations where the car didn't stand up to the conditions.
It really didn't. No. Did you ever go out and do the Swan Series?
Not. It was, well, I went out to Australia, but it was then the Coca-Cola Special. It moved from the Swan, but I did go and do it on my TZ500.
That happens on the V8 commodes and things like that. Things tended to happen.
It did happen. Yeah, it did happen, things like that. But I did go out and do it. It was the Coca-Cola International. I did three races, which was in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. Yeah, that's right. And I went out there and did it on my old TZ500. Had a lot of fun out there with Greg Hansford, because he was still alive then, and he looked after us and took us around. Jeff and Murray Sale, all those guys, same thing. Had an awful lot of fun travelling around out there, having an absolute ball. That would have been the first time I went to Australia. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I spoke to Rog Burnett, I asked him for his hire car story, and he regaled us with the story of you being shot at in South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we got lost and went through a township somewhere. And that's right. Yeah, they were shooting at us. But I worked out that if we kept it above 70, they'd never hit us. They wouldn't give us enough lead. And so we managed to escape death on that occasion. Roger was also with me when we got stopped by the police. I think that was in Czech Republic or somewhere like that. We were travelling somewhere. He was riding, I was team managing. And we got stopped by the police doing 140 mile an hour in my AMG Mercedes or something like that. Thought we were going to prison, and it worked out. They fined us, and we went to change some money up and thought it would be like £1,000. It would turn out to be £22 or something like that. So I'd changed up 100 quid and we'd carried on 140 mile an hour all the way.
Just keep giving him
every time he gets enough money to speed all the way there.
A couple of questions that I have just to finish off. Thank you, Stavros. This has been fantastic.
Absolute pleasure. I still smile at my own stupid stories, actually, which is which great is when you're doing a theatre show, because I can't stop laughing myself.
Tell me one thing about you that nobody else knows. I'll give you a bit of time. These are little left-field questions.
One thing that nobody knows about me. I'm very emotional. My daughter just had a baby, and it's like, you know, it's one of them things that gets you. I even cry at movies and things like that. So, yeah, I'm quite an emotional person, I guess you'd say. Yeah, that's maybe something that people don't know much about me. Other than that, don't know. I'm dyslexic, but I get by.
Yeah.
Doesn't bother me that much. You know, like most things in life, if you've got an ailment, you kind of work around it, don't you?
Of course you do.
Yeah, a couple of little things like that.
Dining room table, three guests, any era. With us, not with us, who are they?
Oh, got to be Barry Sheen. Can I have three people?
You can have three.
Gary Nixon, yeah. Who loved him to bits, great guy. And a fella called Piers Well Forrester. No one will ever heard of Piers Well Forrester. He was an aristocratic fella that I met through Barry, lived in London. Had a big house in Chelsea, but never had any money. He was obviously going to be a trustafarian, I call him, someone that would have inherited money. Tragically got killed at Brands Hatch in 1977, riding a TZ750 Yamaha. When I first met Piers, he was a playboy around London, used to go to tramps and everywhere else. And Barry and I would hook up with him because we'd meet all these posh birds. And sometimes posh blokes that might have some money that sponsor us. So the deal I had with Piers, he would help me meet people and have a great time in London. I would help him learn to ride a bike. And we did exactly that. And he sadly got killed at Brands Hatch. But I wished I'd known him for longer. He was the guy, and again, this might be something that people don't know about. I was in the British Olympic bobsleigh team in winter of 76, 77, because Piers told Prince Michael of Kent, who was the team captain of the British Olympic bobsleigh team, and I was current British motorcycle champion, he told Prince Michael of Kent that I was a fantastic bobsleigher, so we got a free holiday. I went to Eagles in Austria as a trainee for an Olympic bobsleigh team. I'd never seen one until I got there. Had no idea what it did. We crashed it twice on the first two runs and got expelled, but we got a free holiday. But I'd love to see Piers, actually. That is somewhere here. There it is. This was his trophy, and I ended up winning it, and it's of Icarus. The Piers Forrester Trophy of Icarus. Wonderful. Because I think Icarus flew too close to the sun.
It did, yeah.
And that was what it was for.
That's right.
and I won it for winning a race at Brands Hatch, I think it was. Am I still in frame? Yeah, I am.
Yeah, you're fine.
But I'd love to have him at my dining room table, because just to relay some of the stories. I mean, this ridiculous trip. I've met Prince Michael of Kent since, and I got expelled for turning it upside down and not getting out of it and whatever. And I met him at Goodwood, actually, and he said, "Oh, yes, Parrish, I do remember you." But it was in the William Hickey College. Parrish and Forrester joined the Olympic bobsleigh team. I had no idea what they were.
That's wonderful. Mm. What's the one decision you'd change if you could?
To have slowed down 5 miles an hour at the British Grand Prix when I fell off leading it. 1977, I could have been famous, actually. I'd got it in the bag. I got a four-second lead on John Williams starting the last lap, and it started drizzling with rain. And Barry Sheen put the pit board out saying, "Gas it, wanker," instead of saying what I was expecting, last lap, plus four. And it just started drizzling. I just tipped it in Cop's Corner and lost it. Gave away the only person would have been to win the British Grand Prix. No one ever has in the Premier class. John Williams crashed at the next corner. He got the rain because it was who was leading the race. And yeah. Pat Hennen, my teammate at the time, went on to win the race. So that would have put me third in the World Championship, I think. So that's a regret. Don't regret many things. No. Realistically, no, not at all. Probably never have to got married. No, I'm kidding.
Which leads me on to my next question. What's your most embarrassing moment? I don't want to juxtaposition those two.
Right. Very embarrassing moment. I mean, I've done lots of daft things, but one thing that did embarrass me, and I've got, you know, when you get that extra strength because you're embarrassed by something that's happened, it's like you hear people are picking up cars when their children are. Yeah. Yamaha kindly used to give me a new R1 every year for a number of years, even when I was racing trucks, because I had an association with Yamaha having run the team. And Andy Smith used to supply a Yamaha, and it'd go delivered to PH Allen's in Cambridge, and I'd go there in, I don't know, March when it got a bit warmer and pick one up. And on this particular occasion, I had arranged to go and pick the Yamaha up, but also been invited to BBC Radio Cambridge here to do a chat with them about the coming season. And I knew as well as anyone, and they always tell you at the shop, brand new bike, be careful, new tyres are greasy and they need a few miles on them. So I've took it very carefully, 2 miles up the road to BBC Radio Cambridge here, parked up, did the interview, this, that and the other. And I got some friends at my house for a barbecue, left BBC Radio Cambridge here, not thinking about the new tyres, came out the gate, literally went high-sided myself in front of a pub that has got 50 people outside drinking. I think the rugby might have been on and everything else. And there I am, flipping upside down on an R1 Yamaha that had done 2 miles, wearing, I was wearing just a pair of jeans or something like that. And I'd grazed my knee, grazed my elbow. But I picked this bike up quicker than they could even get to me, like you wouldn't believe, and set off again, wheel spinning because the tyres were new and everything else. And thank fuck, I never lifted my visor or anything else like that. But unfortunately, I had Parrish written across my helmet. So that was probably one of my most embarrassing moments.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Mm. One of my favourite questions that we ask of guests is, what was the last thing you did for the first time?
What was the last thing I did for the first time?
Because even as we advance in years, we can still learn new skills and new experiences and things like that. And I find that as part of life is really important.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. In seriousness, the last thing I did for the first time, I bought a dog. No, I didn't buy a dog. I got given a dog. And it's one of the best things. I had dogs when I was a kid, but I've had a life where I couldn't have dogs because I was travelling so much and everything else. And sat down with my missus and we decided to get a dog. And it's one of the best things I've ever done because, A, it makes me go for a walk for about 2 miles every morning. I have a lot of fun with it. It helps my golf because
I hit
golf balls across my field here for a couple of hundred yards if I can. And my dog brings it back, albeit it's chewed the ball to shit and it's not such a good ball afterwards, but and I'm really, really enjoying Nelly, the spaniel, English Springer Spaniel. It must be called Duracell. It's got so much energy, and I thoroughly enjoy it and have a lot of fun with it. So I'm pleased I have.
And last question: who's the most famous person in your phone?
Wow, Mark Webber, maybe. Adrian Newey, a lot of Formula One guys that I get on really well with because they like motorbikes.
Of course.
It used to be George Harrison, but sadly he passed away because George sponsored me for a year. He was probably a guy that I'd spend some time with and things like that. I don't know. I don't know any film stars, I don't think. stuff like that. Yeah, because I don't really mix with all those sort of people. I'm not into music that much. My missus is, but I'm not. Yeah, probably Formula One guys, I guess you'd say, something like that. Yeah, I can't think of any other. I know. Oh, God, I can't remember his name. A guy at Take That I get on really well with. Howard.
Howard from Take That.
Yeah. He's in there because I get to meet him at Goodwood and we get on really well and so on and so on. And I did a car race with him at Silverstone about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. So Howard Donald, yeah.
Howard Donald, yeah.
That'll do.
That's perfect.
Yeah, that's...
What a way to finish it.
Yeah, that'll do the job, won't it?
Stavros, thank you so much. What an absolute pleasure.
A pleasure for
thoroughly
my part.
Enjoyed
yeah,
that.
No problem
thank
whatsoever.
You.
And I hope it makes a few people smile because it still does me. It's ludicrous.
That's the important thing. Hopefully we'll catch up at Goodwood later in the year. Mm-hmm. But maybe at the end of the season when things start to tail off again, I'd love to come down again if you could have us.
If you can't get a ticket for Goodwood, I know the fence that you can get over.
Thank you. That's important. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Parish.
A big thank you again to Stavros for hosting us at his beautiful home and to Chris and his team at Express Coffee for their much appreciated partnership on this week's show. Don't forget, links to all Express Coffee services are in the links below. Let us know your thoughts on this show or any of our shows in the comments or on the social media platforms. And wherever you can, please share the show and spread the love. It really does all help. Next week, it's another show returnee and a popular listen from last year. It's Big Jack Valentine. So until then, thank you so much for listening and please do look after yourselves. Bye-bye.
This has been an Off Track podcast production in association with Graft Ventures.